Welcome to The Detail with me, Katie Melua.
And me, Polly Scattergood.
Today, we have a very special episode.
We do. Described as a one-man sound clash between Lamonte Young and Iggy Pop, we are lucky to be joined by Ivan Avello, award-winning musician, actor, songwriter, and producer, Simon Fisher-Turner. His work ranges from solo albums to art installations around the world, and he's the man behind many of the exquisite soundtracks that we all know and love.
Welcome to The Detail. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, it's been lovingly made by me and Katie. The editing, however, has been done by me, Polly Scattergood, in my studio at home. So if you're a fan of this podcast and you'd like to hear more, receive additional content and the odd special treat sent directly from me to you, please head on over to my Patreon page to show your support. The address is patreon.com/Polly Scattergood. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Simon, welcome.
Hi there, Katie. You're around the corner from me, I think.
Ah, okay, yes. So, West London?
Indeed.
Hey. Oh, if only we could have
all gone to the coast. If only we could have all gone to Bali.
Yes. Well, Simon, it really is an honour to have you here. And today, in this episode, we're going to be discussing aesthetics and why it's important to find a sense of style. So when we talk about the aesthetics and style, what we're talking about is the musical style, that united vision and the worlds that are created. Simon, you've created many worlds, both around your own projects and soundtracking other people's worlds. And we're going to dive into how you have done that.
Okay. It's a high diving board.
Good. Well, that's what we're here for.
Or maybe it's a deep pool. I'm not sure.
Well, can we start at the top of a mountain with the Epic of Everest and go from there? So when I was watching an interview that you did after you had won your Ivan Avello Award, you were talking about how you really enjoyed bouncing off of visual. And I was just wondering, where did that idea begin for you?
Well, it began because of my age. I knew about Mallory and Irving attempting to kind of get to the top and then failing. And so, but I didn't know there was a film about it. And so just being introduced to that world was really interesting because, in fact, I'd done a restoration for the British Film Institute a few years before that about Captain Scott, who I also knew about because of, you know, being the age I am and, you know, they were sort of heroic British figures who failed. But what was really, I mean, Everest, I mean, you can't go wrong, really, can you? The highest mountain in the world, the most beautiful people who live surrounding it, really, on both sides, you know, just that whole part of the world is fascinating. But visually, I was not prepared for the landscapes I was going to see and everything. We had various problems with the Epic of Everest, one of them being sort of not wanting to sound like Tibetan yoga music. Even bells are difficult and things like that, and bells and drones and how do you get around it and everything. And so we had to find a way of doing that. When I say we, I think kind of everybody thinking about it really involved in the end. That was the main problem. And to make something which didn't, what's the word? Where am I trying to get to on this? It didn't, yeah, it almost didn't sensitive. Insult the people without stepping on people's feet, really, you know, politically and geographically, I suppose.
So it's a real tightrope that you're walking, really, having to think of all these different elements before you even really compose a note.
Well, it was in that case. And then my way of trying to do it was to track people down and find musicians. And I found a family. I mean, when I've tried to do this before, some people really, you've come up against lots of resistance. I mean, for instance, I got hold of Chris Bonington, who was really helpful, his secretary, and his side of things were great. But some climbers I talked to were very unhelpful because lots of people now, there's a competitiveness about conquering Everest. And so people are interested in their websites and how much they can help and what am I going to do? Is it going to make any money? And you come across all that sort of thing. But I, in fact, got hold of this incredible family from Nepal and the Madan family, and they just opened up. And he was a musician, and he had a studio in his back garden, and all his friends drank around, sit around, and they drink and they play traditional music. And it was like, wow. I mean, the stuff I did with that family, we recorded in a couple of afternoons, sitting on the sofa, you know, with a Mac propped up, you know, on top of a chair opposite. We just did it on the sofa. There was no studios involved or anything like that, and that was just kind of sitting around playing authentically. That's what I was going to say earlier. I wanted it to be without sort of insulting the authenticity of an Englishman trying to make music about that region. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was an interesting tightrope. And then, you know, it was just a matter of figuring out where to start.
What strikes me is this idea of freshness, Simon. So like you mentioned in your answer earlier how you definitely didn't want it to sound like, you know, yoga music. So this pursuit of, you know, something new and something fresh, I think it's such a difficult challenge, you know, when creating.
Sure.
We also read that you prefer to see moving image before you start writing. And I mean, I've personally always been fascinated by the moving nature of sound in music.
Mm-hmm.
So unlike paintings, we create works that play through time. Could this be why the moving image resonates more for you, perhaps?
You know, I'm 66 now. So when I was a kid, we didn't have a telly. And it was such a new thing. And then I went to a school and they showed films at the school. Moving image to me, it's half finished. So I'm just trying to think if I've ever done anything to a still image, apart from Blue, which of course, with the Derek Jarman film, which is a still image, but actually it's not a still image.
What a film. You've been involved in so many exquisite projects throughout the years. I was astounded to learn that you had 5 albums out as Simon Turner, 4 as the King of Luxembourg, and 27 as Simon Fisher Turner. I mean, that's a lot of albums. How did the aesthetics change throughout those different...
It's projects? Really interesting about aesthetics. I'm just reading, because in fact, I mean, Wikipedia is great, and also, of course, it's not great, but just reading about aesthetics, you know, one of the things it really links to is, funny enough, it gets down to factors involving aesthetic judgment, and that... I suppose I was very unsure of myself as a person until, funnily enough, I met Derek Jarman. And he really kind of gave me an aesthetic which has guided me ever since. And that's kind of trust your instincts and trust people. And if you like somebody, why wouldn't you want to work with them? If you don't get on with somebody, don't. You know, just follow your instinct to a certain extent, which I think is a... really, really good thing to do. I mean, I've accidentally sort of done what I've done. You know, I'm not an academic person, so I'm more instinctive and probably more aesthetic than I even realize. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's just magnificent that, you know, you learned that from Derek.
Oh, he was just, I mean, but he was, you know, because he had this thing about, do you want to do it or don't you want to do it? And he said, don't get flustered about it. If you ask somebody if they wanted to be in the film and they go, oh, what's it about? So you tell them what it's about. It's about Caravaggio. And they go, who's he? Like I did when he said, do you want to, you know, work in Caravaggio? I hadn't got a clue who Caravaggio was. And he said, well, get the extra. So it was all about asking people whether they wanted to be in a film. They'd say, what kind of film? You go, it's a film about an Italian painter, described to them. And they could either go, yes, I'd really love to do that. Or they could go, no. And he said, don't worry if they go, no. It just means just that they don't want to do it or whatever. But if they go, yes, then you go, oh, great, I'm moving forwards. And it's all kind of about moving forwards as opposed to, I mean, don't misunderstand me, I have retreated in my life definitely a few times by, you know, with musicians and all sorts of things. But it is always great to go forwards.
And that's such an interesting idea, though, too, that, you know, if the answer is no from an actor or from a possible collaborator, you don't get worried about it and you don't get lumbered down by that emotionally. I think that's a very sort of, it's a very humanistic thing that one can do.
Yeah, I mean, so, I think...
Yeah, it's magnificent.
Yeah, no, I mean, Derek, without... I don't know whether he realised he did it, but, I mean, you know, for us who worked with him, certainly for me who worked with him, you know, I mean, The reason I first worked with him, I think, was because I had a driving license, and it was like, okay, Simon, you can drive, go and, you know, whatever. And then the music thing came much later. And it was, you know, I didn't even know if he could do it. I didn't know whether I could do it. He didn't know whether I could do it. It's like, okay, then, you know, and off we went. I mean, the way it happened, as far as I pretty much remember it, is that I was sitting on King's Road and a bloke came up to me and he said, are you Simon Turner? I said, yes. He said, I interviewed you when you were 17 years old. And I went, oh, God. He said, you were really, really kind of big-headed and obnoxious and everything like that. And I went, shit, God, I'm really sorry. And he said, what are you doing? And I said, nothing really. He said, do you need a job, you know? And I went, what makes you think that? He said, well, you're just kind of hanging around doing nothing. And I went, yeah, sure. He said, well, this is a company, we film company, et cetera, et cetera. Why don't you come and up to the office tomorrow? So I went to this office, which was called a company called Megalovision, run by these two film producers. And they were just finishing this film, Jubilee. And I got a job making lunch. And then, because I had a driving licence, so I helped make lunch, and then a driving licence, and I'm driving people around, I'm introduced to Derek, and it all goes from there. I didn't know about Derek at all.
Simon, I'm very sorry to say, I wasn't aware of Derek either, you know, and I realise now what a catastrophe that is. And Polly has been, you know, telling, she was like, you need to know who Derek Jarman is. Like, that's just insane.
Yeah.
And, you know, I did start researching. Now, one of the sort of iconic films, Blue.
Yes.
It's something that's described on the BFI website as a metaphorical reflection of his own blindness. And Derek Jarman, this is the description of it. It's stunning. Derek Jarman showed just a blue frame, a monochrome surface inspired by French painter Yves Klein, I hope I've pronounced that correctly, shown throughout the performance, accompanied by your synthesized music and words spoken by Nigel Terry, John Quentin and Tilda Swinton.
I mean, this Blue was life-changing because, you know, when apart from Derek being great fun and kind of showing... Well, you know, he was like a teacher without being a teacher. I think most people who sort of worked with him and didn't really know what they were doing in life suddenly found that working with this guy was pretty amazing, and so we all loved it. And then he came up, when he came up with Blue, it's just like, he said, I want to do this feature film about Yves Klein, who I'd never heard of, and there are no images apart from a blue image, which doesn't move, and I thought, wow, yeah, okay, this is going to be fun, this is radical. And it was like, just from the very beginning, it was so exciting. And so, I mean, really, the idea was, how do we make this film? And he tried to raise money. I tried to raise money. I actually, funnily enough, went to Japan and got some money from a company in Japan. And I came back to England and told Derek about it. But the reason we didn't accept the deal was because... they wanted to shoot it with high-definition video cameras, and Derek wanted to shoot it all on celluloid and make it 35 mil proper so it would actually degrade. So actually, when you see the film, a proper version of the film as opposed to a video version of the film, it's probably one of the few 35 mil prints which degrades. So at the beginning of each reel changes, it's really hairy, it's aged, and it's incredible. And this was one of the sort of... This was really, really intriguing, I have to say. I also have to say, when he came up with this concept of a film with just one image of Blue, talking about, based on a blue called IKB, International Klein Blue, which is a paint invented by this, I was going to say madman then, but possibly he was, called Yves Klein, who is a painter. I didn't know anything about Yves Klein. One of the great things about Derek was he'd talk to you and he'd come up with these crazy ideas. He did a film about Edward II. I had no idea about Edward II. He did a film about Yves Klein. I had no idea. I'd never even heard of Caravaggio, you know. So this was a man who I somehow was working with. And he was, a lot of us involved just loved working with Derek because he was such a giver as opposed to a, you know, I don't know, yeah, he was such a giver.
It's just wild hearing all these stories about him. And I have to say, the first time I watched Blue, I think something in my mind changed, and it was this realization that you can create art and it can exist in its own little space, and it doesn't have to conform to any rules. And it's just such a beautiful film and so subtle, and it really was life-changing for me, to be honest.
Oh, well, that's good. I mean, it did as a film, as a kind of finished film. It went, you know, to get to the state it got in, i.e. Derek started talking about himself, which wasn't the original idea at all. And it became, you know, sort of him talking about his illness and AIDS and everything like that, but encompassing all sorts of other things. And so it went on this incredible journey from sort of just coming up with the idea, which he came. I mean, I'll never forget Edinburgh Film Festival, and he ran down the hill literally saying, Simon, I've got this brilliant idea for a film. It's completely blue. There's, you know, no, it's completely blue. Nothing happens. It's brilliant. Do you want to do it? And I'm going, yes, absolutely fabulous. You know, not even knowing who Eve Klein was, you know, I mean, that was the beauty of the man. But he obviously was, he was pretty instrumental in getting me involved in doing music for films, I think. Was it? Yeah, pretty certain, yeah. I mean, I wasn't really interested. He was a big, he still is, he's a big, big part of my thought process, I think.
I think it'd be lovely to come back to the, you know, to the films. But before we go there, I know this insane story about the Deaf Feel Project and how you actually got signed. Could you tell us about that and what happened?
I wonder what you've heard. Well, and what can I remember? How did it... tell me what you know, Kate, and I'll say.
Okay, so that you'd taken the tapes round to the record companies trying to get a deal with Quiet Music, but that nobody was interested. And then that the, you know, you guys came up with the idea that if you were two French girls,
might
work.
Yes.
So how did that happen? You know, and did it?
Well,
I assume it worked.
It did. It kind of worked. Yeah, because what happened was that I worked at a record company at one stage, and I'd met various musicians, and I met this guy Colin, and we started talking. Now we're just thinking about the girls here, so I really have to kind of get happened. Yeah. So. Colin and I wanted to work together and under sort of some sort of thing. And we just thought, well, let's invent the girl. Am I saying this right? Yeah, invent the girls. And we had to write. Basically, it's very quiet music. And we couldn't get a deal anywhere. So I was with a friend of mine, that's right, Philip, who lives in America. And he's an old friend of mine since I was sort of a teenager. And he and I spent the weekend together, and I told him about the problem about these people, and he said, well, just invent these characters. So we spent the weekend writing biographies of two fictional French girls, and we took it from there. And then we actually went to a private financier to raise the money to make the record, who I'm not quite sure how I met Brian Montgomery, but he was an interesting man. He was like, in the old-fashioned days, you call him an angel, somebody you kind of go to who was friends of friends somehow. And if you took him an idea which he liked, he maybe finance it. And so these were called angels. And so he gave us the money to record the album. And then I had heard about Rough Trade Records, and I approached Simon at Rough Trade. And you could do a deal in those days where... they would pay, it's called P&D, they'd pay for the production and development, and you pay for everything else. And so I went along to these meetings pretending to be the manager of these two fictitious French girls. and we got it sorted.
You got it. But was there a moment when these French girls had to materialise?
Yes.
In some kind of a performance?
And yes, we performed once. We performed once at it was called The Venue in Victoria, and it was a beautiful, well, it's a beautiful theatre. It's still there, but...
And what did the label say? Did they ever find out?
Well, Rough Trade didn't find out until after two albums.
Wow.
But to do this, we did a P&D deal. We weren't on Rough Trade. Rough Trade distributed it. And so in those days, like the beginning of Start Your Own Labels and everything like that. So we started a label called Papier-Mâché Records. And we just invented the whole history of the girls. And then, of course, we wanted to play it live. We supported a band called the Monochrome Set at the venue. And as the curtains opened, we were actually on stage dressed already with our legs crossed, with sort of scarves around our necks to hide our Adam's apples. Wigs Great. From Wig Creations, full makeup, dresses, which we'd, you know, bought all sorts of places, you know, from our girlfriends, friends and all sorts of things. And we had a band. I can't remember exactly who was playing, but we had a band. We played to a backing tape and we played live for about 35 minutes. And then we finished. And then the curtains didn't close, which was a bit of a pain, but that means we had to get up and walk, which suddenly we were sort of like, hang on a moment, how do we walk as ladies? This is going to be It was very funny. I mean, funny enough, this sounds like a promotional thing, but we've got an album coming out. We've got another album coming out in... Later in the year, I think, yeah.
Oh, that's exciting.
Which is
have the French girls got any older and wiser, or are they? Exactly
no, the great
same?
Thing about no, the back, great thing about the girls is we use the original. We keep on using any photographs we've got of the girls, and we don't, they've never changed.
They don't age.
No, they don't.
Oh, the dream. So. Can I ask, do you feel like inventing these different characters, Dufy and King of Luxembourg, do you feel like that doing that enables you to move completely freely as an artist?
It was kind of, I don't think we had much option because with the girls, we just had to, there was no alternative. The King of Luxembourg character was invented by the record company, who just gave me a long list of who would you like to be. And I went, oh, I'll be the King of Luxembourg. That'll be fun. Because it involved dressing up, which is really good. I enjoyed that very much. But so I like a bit of dressing up. But
do you find that putting on a costume changes how you write and compose?
What changes so for instance, if you're working for a film, you're kind of working, the director's the boss and the images give you the thoughts. With the King of Luxembourg writing songs, I don't know about both of you, but you know, I tend to sort of think, wow, I've got this great idea for a song, and I get maybe a couple of verses in and then I get stuck and I call up a mate. You know, I'm a bit like that program where you have to phone a friend. Having said that, now my approach is just to jot down things which I've done, say, for the last year, and just things which have happened, and I'm much more inclined now to kind of just free fall and just go for it lyrically, quickly in the studio. For instance, in a studio situation, you know, write really quickly in the studio, but based on sort of notes I've got about me, as opposed to finished songs, as it were.
Hey, that's interesting, because Katie, you work a lot like that, don't you?
Yeah. Absolutely. And I find actually, Polly, to your question about, you know, becoming different characters, you know, it's actually one of the reasons why we've called this podcast The Detail, because I think every single detail matters, you know, and it's like even the weather outside, you know, one of the episodes was about the environment that we work in. So like, what's the building like? What's the atmosphere like? What are the noises surrounding you? You know, and then what you wear, like I find a dress can completely change my mood and my state, and then I perform totally differently. To this idea of just collecting as much as possible from life, that really helps. And actually that brings us on to, you know, this great album which we mentioned at the start, featuring your family, Simon. I mean, I know your children are teenagers now, but you recorded these beautiful sound bites throughout their life.
Yes.
And I have to say, listening to it made me think about the perspective of an artist and this idea of us needing to observe the world and seeing things, you know, sort of differently. One thing that both me and Polly loved about this record is how you have so beautifully combined your family life and work life into one sort of incredible piece. Because so often, like in society, there's, you know, these two elements are kept so separate, right? Mm. They're sectioned off from one another. Yeah, and I just think it's great that you've brought them together and you've created this beautiful bridge. How do you sort of think about that?
My wife's a film editor, and so that's a very time-consuming job. And once upon a time, she was an assistant film editor, and then we thought we'd give it a go at really her being a film editor. So then we thought we'd try and have kids, and then that wasn't as easy as we thought. And then we had a daughter, and then we had Jasper as well. And so it just became obvious that I should really become mum, as it were, in the old-fashioned sexist way of thinking about things. So that's what I did. She worked really hard and sort of brought home the bacon, and I did all the nappies and all that. And it was very... So obviously it just became kind of crazy not to record things, for instance, with the kids. And just, yeah, so it's been a pleasure, obviously, spending so much time with the kids. And I didn't really ever particularly mean to put a record out. Well, maybe I did in the long run, but I mean, it's because having the children stopped me being a fantastically selfish artist. How about that? Mm. but I'm still fantastically selfish. but I think I've applied it I applied in a different sort of way now, because you know when you have kids, it changes your whole perspective on the world. But I don't think it has to stop you thinking about other stuff, you know.
Well, exactly, you know, to blur the line between.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we had fun doing it. I don't know. I mean, we don't sit down and listen to that record and go, oh my God, you know, it's so, but it was fun doing things and trying things out, and they'd come to concerts and I was always dragging them around art galleries and, you know, trying things and getting them to make funny noises. And it just seemed kind of natural. It seemed a very natural thing to do because it was made over, you know, 15 years or so. But I've always been interested, you know, my dad gave me a cassette recorder when I was a kid, and I've always been interested in recording sounds, and that's been a whole kind of world of mine without even realising who John Cage was or Found Sounds or knowing anything about, you know, the sort of seriousness of sound artists. But I appear to have kind of been doing that for a long time without realising it. Mm-hmm.
You just capture these little magical moments that you can then look back on like a diary. It's what an amazing time capsule to have and look back on.
Do you, have you been, re- you've been, must have been recording your daughter, Polly?
Yeah, of course. I mean, poor thing. Every time I press record, she stops talking. But yeah, I love collecting her little noises.
I mean, the great thing about sound is that it still leaves a lot to your imagination. If you look at a photograph, a bit like if you look at a film, you know, it's visually in front of you. But if you're listening to something, it's oral. It's like when you listen to a record without visuals, your concentration is displaced in a different sort of way, isn't it, in your brain? And when you have real sound, you know, life's. I tend to my recordings of the kids. I think of them as being life recordings.
Oh, I love that.
You know, whether it's. I mean, for instance, what happened the other day? Jasper, he was doing something. Recorded him. Oh, he's taken up kind of boxing, and he says he's got a punch box outside. And I suddenly started recording him boxing. But so the other day, I just recorded him for 10 minutes. Boxing here, this and that, and I've just made a piece about it, you know. Whether it's any good or not, I don't know, but I'd still, just recording life, I think I've just always done it, really.
So talking about recording sounds, can I ask you about recording silence? Because I know that silence is something that you have talked about many times, and you taught me. Where do you begin with silence? How did you learn about it, and what's your view on it?
Again, it's something probably back to Derek when we were... He explained one day when we were doing Caravaggio about the painter, and he, you know, I'd done some music for a scene, and he just said, no, just take out the music. And it was fine without the music. It was fine with it, but it was like, well, do you need it? I I think now in this crowded world of, you know, the sound everywhere, everything's everything, my work is getting more and more minimal. I was looking for silence from this film about Captain Scott again, and Chris Watson, who's a BBC sound recordist, I met him one evening after I'd actually been commissioned to do the music for this film. It's called The Great White Silence, and it's about Captain Scott going to Antarctica and dying. But he said he'd just come back from Antarctica and he had this film, which is this recording of sound from inside Captain Scott's hut. And it's almost silent. He said it's the quietest place he's ever been on Earth. And this is from the BBC sound recordist. You know, he's the most beautiful sound recordist. And he said, do you want that? And that was the beginning of me working on the Scott film, because he'd given me this recording of Captain Scott's hut in Antarctica, but it wasn't silent, but it was as near to silence in nature as he could get. And he went, oh, well, you could have that, you know, if that's helpful. I went, Mike, that's the beginning, that's brilliant, I'm off. And so, you know, when Captain Scott dies, we cut to a minute of not silence, but it is as clear as we can get to that kind of silence. And then you've got the lovely silence, you know, the cenotaph, you know, when you remember everybody killed in the wars, you know, November, that silence is really good, but it's never silent, but it's a nice concentration thing, isn't it? It's good for the soul, a bit of silence.
I think it's also, you know, I think when artists create, it's good to just react and be aware of the sequence of things, you know. And we live in worlds that are very noisy, in terms of, you know, culture and different styles and different artists, you know. And I guess to find that the thing that's different, you know, that you can sort of do, that you can contribute to, like, I think that I'd say that's really important. And it's just fascinating to hear. I'd love to know what you've learnt as a real master of carving out different and distinctive styles.
I never practice. I know what black notes do and I know what white notes do. And I try and avoid the clash. But then if I hit the clash, then there's an old Brian Eno thing. If you make a mistake, do it again and it's not a mistake. And that can be very interesting.
I love that.
That can be a really interesting route to follow, you know, because it immediately, so it becomes, it's a mistake, and then it becomes something deliberate, and then it becomes something, because it's deliberate, you could then build on that, and that will take you to new territory.
You know, as you say, you've got these elements, which is, you know what the black keys do, know what the white keys do, avoid the clash, if there's a mistake, make it again. You know, those are the parameters, I guess.
Yeah, I have to be able to maybe my style is the fact that I have to be able to rationalise sensibly to somebody who knows nothing about what I'm doing, You know, if I can actually rationalise it and say, listen, this is the reason I'm doing it, then that possibly could be my style, because it has to make sense to me. Now, I think that's probably something to do with aesthetics. Mm-hmm.
I mean, the reason that you always come into my head when I think of aesthetics is you have worked on so many different projects, but they all seem to have this running theme. They all seem to be very real and honest and you know. And so however different you become and whatever different adventures you go on, you always seem to have this thread that runs through it that feels honest and real. And I love that.
Well, that's very kind. I mean, honest and real, you can't, that's, I'll buy that as a style. But it's true. You know, I mean, you know, when listen to lyrics, you know, lyrics have to touch you, music has to touch you, and they touch you in different ways and things touch you in different ways. But again, this actually, funnily enough, all leads back to Derek Jarman, who, you know, I was a kind of, before Derek, there's definitely a before Derek and after Derek. My life changed completely after it because he just changed the way I thought about everything, because he sort of opened the door and said, but you could just do what you want or whatever. You know what I mean? You don't have to, there are no rules. And I've also thought that was really good. Obviously, you have to, you know, not hurt people and things like that. You have, you know, have some common sense. But basically, you know, let's have an adventure.
Well, yeah, it's that feeling of an adventure, you know, not being afraid and not being afraid to trust yourself, I guess.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
And I'd say it takes a, for me, it's definitely taken a long time to kind of accept that and be like, okay, well, no one else is going to sort it out apart from me in terms of those decisions about, you know, how to write, how to convince myself that it's worth creating another record, you know, to put it out into the world.
I mean, Katie, have you ever heard the album Tilt by Scott Walker?
Oh, I haven't.
Okay.
I'm going to check it. I'm looking it up right now.
Check it out, because this was a record for me almost more than any record in the last 30 years, probably totally changed how I thought about music and, in parentheses, songs or anything like that.
It's Tilt.
It is Tilt, Scott Walker. Okay. Mind-boggling. And then I read an interview years ago, about, I don't know, 10 years ago, David Bowie talking about Tilt. He said... Even he couldn't fathom it out. There's nothing to, you know, there's nothing to fathom out. Just get in there. It's like, oh my God, you know, mind boggling. And that was altered. And I found, funny enough, after Tilt came out, I was in Mute and I was doing an album for Mute and it influenced me terribly. But then I realized it kind of, it hadn't come across in the music, but it had come across in my way of thinking about words and sound. Isn't that weird?
And that, yeah, and it's incredible. I mean, you know, actually having, discovering records and the influence they have on us, I mean, we all know what that means, but I think that does build a sense of who then you become and how you see music and, you know, and your sense of style, because you're like, okay, these are my gods.
Yes. I have to say, Kate, that you work with this guitarist who's a god of mine called Chris Spedding, and...
Oh, yes, Chris.
You know.
Brilliant.
And I have to say, when I went to see his 50th anniversary gig in some place.
Oh, yes.
And you were there, and I was there.
I was there.
Yeah,
of
and
course.
I thought, good on you, because he's the man for me, you know. He's just.
I know, he's just wonderful, isn't he?
Just glorious.
Yeah, he really is. I mean, the way he plays and actually what it is, it's like he's got the whole personality and it's just there and it just seems to like pour out of him.
Mm,
you know,
yeah.
It's so natural.
He is so natural. And that's, I have to say, the most, you know, I love the fact that I'd have no idea where he's going. I think I might have a clue, but I just love this man's playing, because it's just, as you say, it's just natural. And it comes and it's mind-bogglingly restrained and just beautiful and really felt. Yeah, we love that as musicians. We love to be kind of caressed with sound and art and everything. Yeah, God, we're lucky human beings. We're really lucky.
Simon, can I just ask, you mentioned about the Defee project coming out. Where can people find you online, on social media and stuff? Have you got a website?
Social media stuff. I do Twitter, but I don't know. You could start at Mute Records, but I think we're all out there in one way or another.
Yeah, of course. Oh, how magnificent. Simon, thank you so much. And thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks to everyone who's tuned in, and great to chat to you, Simon.
It's my pleasure. Have a great day.
We will see you next time.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, it's been lovingly made by me and Katie. The editing, however, has been done by me in my studio. So if you're a fan of this podcast and you'd like to hear more, receive additional content and the odd special treat sent directly from me to you, please head on over to my Patreon page to give your support. The address is patreon.com/polyscattergood. Thanks so much.